Almost 3 years later, we're still perplexed by what happened to the El Faro. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It was September of 2015 when the El Faro sank near the Bahamas when it rode into Hurricane Joaquin. 33 people lost their lives. That same day, another cargo ship sank further south, but the entire crew was rescued, and that ship didn't make many headlines. We're going to talk to the author of a new book that followed the tragic journey of both ships. Also, we'll have a conversation about the challenges Miami Beach is facing with their roads, bridges, and their water. And finally, what would you consider an odd flavor of beer? Well, we talked to the creator of one of the most popular craft brews in the world, right out of Wynwood. That's Sundial, coming up next. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the city of Miami Beach faces a set of unique challenges over the coming years and decades. It's extremely vulnerable to sea level rise and increasingly powerful hurricanes. The city's roads are taking on millions of tourists each year, and bridges are equally burdened. Roy Coley is the new director of public works for Miami Beach, is tasked with overseeing these challenges, and he's been working with the city since 2015. Before that, he spent 10 years working in the Keys on water management systems. Roy, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Louis. Pleasure to be here.
So you took this position, I mean, it was just this past month, so very new job for you.
Very new job, yes.
You just take the position, but you're not unfamiliar with the area. So, I mean, as you're moving into the post, what are some of the big challenges that you're facing right off the bat?
Well, the Public Works Department manages some of the most essential needs of the city, our drinking water, our wastewater, stormwater, sanitation, streets and street maintenance are all under the purview of the Public Works Department, and each one of those has needs and challenges.
And, I also was chatting with you just before the program. I mean, you know, people in the city, you know, they will go out and seek out the mayor or any of the city officials if they feel they have to ask a question or if they've got an issue with something. But I wonder how often do they come and search you out to talk to you about issues?
Well, very fortunate. I see the residents of our community very often. We have community meetings on a regular basis. We make ourselves available via telephone or in-person meetings. We have an active community, and we're happy to engage with them, and I speak with residents almost daily.
What do they tell you? What are the things that Miami Beach residents are most concerned about right now?
Well, different residents in different communities of the city have other priorities. Some are concerned about traffic and transportation issues. Some live in the lower portions of the city, and they're more worried about sea level rise and how we're going to adapt and how we're going to thrive as a community going forward.
So now you're in this position. What are your priorities? What's at least at the top of your list?
Well, our number one priority for the community is sea level rise adaptation. That is all coastal communities' biggest challenge right now, and Miami Beach is dedicated to setting the standard for everyone else to follow, and we'll show the world how to thrive in these situations.
Yeah, Miami Beach is part of, as you already know, the 100 Resilient Cities Projects. That's a grant-funded initiative from the Rockefeller Foundation. Explain the focus of the project and, again, Miami Beach's role in that.
Well, the 100 Resilient Cities is a compact that Miami Beach is a part of in partnership with Miami-Dade County and the City of Miami, called Greater Miami and the Beaches. And it's a group that studies the resiliency efforts and how for all of us to adapt better.
Right now, again, because you're new in the post, but you've been in the city now a few years, I mean, what do you tell people when they ask, is Miami Beach, is the area of Miami ready for what's coming for Mother Nature? Is it a resilient city?
Miami Beach is a resilient city. We have a long way to go to fully adapt. We will never be complete with our adaptation. It's going to be an ongoing process for the rest of our lives. But Miami Beach has the wherewithal. We have the expertise. We have shown the world we know how to do it. And what we will do is continue to improve each one of our neighborhoods as we move forward.
All right. There was a panel of experts from the Urban Land Institute. They visited Miami Beach a few weeks ago to give recommendations on the city's stormwater management system. What did you take away from that visit?
That was a really exciting visit. The Urban Land Institute came to Miami Beach, sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation, and they took a look at how we are affecting stormwater management. They looked at raising streets, pumps, the different types of infrastructure we use. The exciting part of their visit was we had 10 world-renowned experts from all over the world with different disciplines in their background. And what they said was that Miami Beach has done a good job managing our challenges of rising sea levels, and they had nothing but accolades for what we had done so far. They also made many suggestions of how they thought we could get even better by increasing our blue and green infrastructure in combination with what they call gray infrastructure, which is streets and pumps.
All right, yeah, let's talk about that. Hold on. Blue, green, and gray infrastructure. What is that? I think I know, but no, help me understand.
Well, that is a nomenclature that's become somewhat common in the resiliency world. And gray infrastructure is engineering and construction. In our case, our gray infrastructure is raising our roads, installing stormwater pipes, and mechanical pumps to move high tides and stormwater away. Green infrastructure is more focused around landscaping, using grassy areas, trees, shrubs, and things like this to purify water, to percolate water, and to manage water. And then blue infrastructure would be how you live with water, how you have waterways, how you have water remain in existence in either ponds, lakes, or wetlands, or things of that nature. And so what they encouraged us to do is to add even more green infrastructure to our current gray infrastructure to make us better.
Let's talk about the temporary pumps. This goes to the gray, I suppose, right? The gray part of it, the infrastructure. They've been put in place to address the king tide phenomenon. From what you've seen, how are they working? I mean, what could be improved there?
Well, you've got temporary pumps and you also have permanent pumps. When I joined the city in 2015, we had historical high king tides that fall, and we saw many of our streets that were a foot deep in water, and they weren't safe for traffic and they weren't safe for emergency services. We immediately deployed temporary pumps to where we could pump that water out of the streets and keep those streets safe for people to move around on. And as a temporary measure, they worked, and they helped mitigate what we were facing. In our neighborhoods where we have performed the full redevelopment and have permanent pumps in place, they have worked impeccably. We have these pumps that when the storms have come during Hurricane Irma, and we've also had multiple years of historic high king tides, our pumping system and raised roads have worked, and we've shown that they do what we need them to do.
Another part of the gray aspect is the roads. So again, talking about infrastructure, and that's been another conversation, is raising roads. How do you decide which roads are raised? And really, don't you have to raise them all? Because if you raise this road, the water just will flow down to the lower road, won't it?
Well, yes, but in Miami Beach, we have on the coastal side of the beach, we have some very high areas that are high enough in elevation, those roads do not need raising. On the bay side of the beach, we have more areas that are low, and they're closer to sea level. When the king tides and storm events come in, they're not capable of conveying the water off the roads, and those are the ones that we are most concentrated on raising to get above what our current need is and projecting out 30 years for sea level rise.
Again, I'm talking with Roy Coley, the new director of public works for Miami Beach, just took the job this past month. And again, talking about some of the challenges that Miami Beach is facing as it moves forward. You know what? So that's, we talked about gray. I want to ask you about green, because you said you were told that they suggested that more green would be good. I'm taking that as that what? More trees, more parks. What's more green?
Well, they gave us a verbal description of their observance and intend to give us a full written report in 60 days. And the conversation was to look for more opportunities to plant trees, more opportunities to use swale ways beside the roads and turn them into greenery that will absorb water and contain water, Any type of vegetation and any opportunity to increase vegetation was what was being referenced.
And so, I mean, realistically, you know, how fast could that happen? And do you think that, I mean, the city is ready to do that right now?
Well, certainly. Our city manager, Jimmy Morales, has directed all of staff to maximize every opportunity we can to add more green and blue infrastructure into our projects, and we are actively pursuing that now.
Statewide, Florida is facing, because I want to ask, just move a little bit over to water, especially water issues, but not so much flooding, but the water that we use and drink. Statewide, Florida faces serious concerns when it comes to the quality of the tap water. A report from the RNDC found that the state ranks second nationwide for the number of people impacted by violations by safe drinking water. Where does Miami Beach's water quality stand right now?
Our drinking water is excellent. Our drinking water is provided to us from Miami-Dade County, and their original source for the drinking water is the Biscayne Aquifer. The Biscayne Aquifer serves almost all of the population from somewhere close to Fort Lauderdale South, and in most cases you would define it as a pristine source. So we're extremely fortunate that our water source is naturally clean and that we have a partner like Miami-Dade County that provides that water to us, and it's just not a concern we should have as far as quality.
I'm shooting through a couple of different things here because there is a lot to cover. Another thing too, this may go back to the gray, which is roads. And, you know, the demand on this city, because it's a growing city, you've got 8.7 million tourists visiting Miami Beach last year alone. And at one point, this was during St. Patrick's Day, the city decided got to close MacArthur Causeway coming in just so we hold off on all the people. Too many people at one point. Memorial Day weekend's coming up. Is the city planning on closing bridges? What are you doing to, I mean, how are the roads holding up?
Well, physically, the roads are holding up well. The question that you're posing is more of a safety concern, and that's the decision of our police chief and our police command officers, and they make the decision at that time if they believe that the roads already are overpopulated, and they'll make that call if it's necessary, and in their judgment, safe for the city.
Do we have too many people in Miami Beach? I mean, do we have to talk more about public transit? Is that a conversation that has to be had?
Traffic is always a concern in Miami Beach. Most people find themselves frustrated in rush hour, but it is a fact of life. We're a tourist destination. We're a popular place to be, not unlike New York City or San Francisco or any other iconic city. Traffic is a problem, and we would continue to work to be more efficient at moving that traffic, but we will have to live with some.
All right, so you just started the job, but what are your goals, Roy? What are you looking for in the next 10, 15 years? What do you think you need to do, and where is the city going?
Our goals are to increase our resiliency, deal with the shocks and stresses of climate change and any other emergency that comes along, and that includes our sea level rise adaptation, that includes our infrastructure for our drinking water, our wastewater, our sanitation team, just to make our city more livable and more enjoyable.
Yeah, but one of the aspects too, as you said, the blue, the green, and the gray, one of the blue is the fact that we have to learn to live with water. So what do you think is going to happen in the next 15, 20 years, and how much more water do we have to learn to live with?
Well, the Urban Land Institute did make a point that we as a community needed to learn to live with water more than we seem to be prepared to. And as sea level rises, and none of us know exactly how much the sea level might rise over the next 30 years, but projections indicate it might be a foot. And with a foot increase in sea level rise, we will have to either raise streets or learn to live with water in our streets.
Are you getting total buy-in from the public, from the politicians, and from the commercial side of it? I mean, from industry?
Almost all of our communities unified that they support sea level rise mitigation and these plans. We all seem to have different thoughts on what might be better and what percentage of these projects should be gray versus green infrastructure. It's a very healthy conversation our community's having, and we're prepared to continue that conversation and ultimately prove to the world how to do it right.
Miami Beach trying to set the tone for everybody else. Roy Coley, the new director of Public Works for Miami Beach, again, just took the post this past month. Roy, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come, A new book is out that follows the story of the El Faro on that tragic night that it sank in Hurricane Joaquin. There was a second ship that sank that night, but it didn't get a lot of headlines. Why not? We're going to have more on Sundial coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, it's been 2.5 years since the tragedy of the El Faro sinking. 33 people on board lost their lives when the cargo ship went straight into Hurricane Joaquin. On that same day, another cargo ship, the Minouche, also sank, but the entire crew was saved. The stories of these two ships and their crews are told in a new book called Into the Storm, Two Ships, a Deadly Hurricane, and an Epic Battle for Survival. It's written by Tristram Corton, and he's going to be discussing the book, by the way, at Books and Books in Coral Gables on Friday. This Friday, 8 o'clock, admission is free. Tristram, great to have you in here finally. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Lewis.
You know, when did you start thinking about digging into the story about the El Faro?
As soon as it happened, as soon as the news that the ship had gone missing, I became kind of horrified and fascinated. I've grown up on the ocean, both here and in New England, and I know and am terrified by its power, but also entranced by it, and this seemed to encapsulate all of that. So yeah, so as soon as it happened, I started paying very close attention and looking at these events.
I wanted to know from you, from the headlines and all the stories that were in the media, from television to radio to print, what was it that was jumping out at you about this story?
Well, just the fact that a nearly 800 foot long vessel could disappear. I mean, that is not common. So close to land. I mean, these were, you know, this ship disappeared right off the coast of some of the Bahamian islands. So the idea that they could just vanish like this floating city practically seemed incomprehensible.
When did you find out about the second ship? This is a story that isn't told that often. You didn't get a lot of headlines. The Minouche.
Right.
When did you find out about that?
So, yeah, I mean, I'll just be brutally honest. I'm a journalist. I'm a freelance journalist. I work alone. And, you know, part of my fascination with this also meant this was something I wanted to try and write about. The national media was covering El Faro extensively, which they should have, and they were doing a good job, a very good job, updating. I mean, it was on the nightly news. It was on the major national newspapers, etc. But nonetheless, I began to look at the Coast Guard's reports on it, and I would go to their public affairs website and review what they had written. And in one of the press releases, I mean, it was very small, but it was a mention of this middle-of-the-night rescue of this other cargo ship that went down. And it was very terse. I mean, the Coast Guard, God bless them, does not do a good job tooting its own horn. But I read that, and then I ended up calling up to the air station where the crew that went out to rescue these sailors was based. And I asked one of the petty officers there. I said, "Is this a kind of, you know, what kind of happens in this operation?" He said, "Well, a helicopter went out and it dropped a swimmer into the water, and he rescued the people." And I said, "Wait a minute! He dropped a swimmer. They dropped a swimmer into the water. This was the middle of the night." At the edge of a hurricane, in driving rain, in 20-foot seas, and game over. I was smitten at that point.
So let's look at this story. This is what's really fascinating about this, and the way that you wrote the story out is really we get this profile of two different captains.
Yeah.
The captain of the El Faro, Michael Davidson, and then the other captain, Ranello Helera.
Helera, yeah.
Helera, the captain of the Minouche. Davidson, again, the captain of the El Faro, who is he? Well, how would you describe him to people?
Yeah, you know, you picked up on an important point that was not apparent to me or wasn't at the, you know, top of my consciousness when I started this project. But you're absolutely right. The difference in these two captains and their approach had everything to do with the end result. Captain Davidson was a career mariner. I mean, he graduated from Maine Maritime Academy. He's from Maine, coastal Maine. grew up on the water and had lived it his whole life. He had crewed vessels in Alaska, in the Alaska trade, both oil tankers and cargo ships. So he knew what he was doing. But by the time he took over the helm of El Faro, he had a reputation as a stateroom captain, which means a captain who is more comfortable in the office adjoining his cabin, monitoring events on the computer and tracking what he needs to track there, than walking the deck and talking to the crew and, you know, examining the ship. And that, coupled with his over-reliance on technology, you know, was fateful in this instance.
All right. So one of the, you know, one of the disturbing aspects of this story is, again, knowing what happens and yet reading through this. I mean, basically, you have the transcript of the final moments for the El Faro. And I want to talk about what happened in the El Faro. And we have a little passage here. This gives us a little taste of who Captain Davidson was and how he handled himself, if you don't mind reading that for
yes.
us.
Yes. Lewis selected this for me to read. So I'm going to look at it for the first time now. Okay. And I should tell people that the reason we can go into so much detail about what happened in the bridge of a ship that sank is that they recovered the voyage data recorder from nearly 3 miles down. It's like the black box on an airplane, and it recorded 26 hours of conversation on the bridge. So I'm not making any of this up. There was the sound of crashing outside. "There goes the lawn furniture," Randolph, the second mate, quipped. Then the second mate, who had the radar working again, turned to the captain. "If you don't need me out, you want me to stay with you?" she asked. "Please," the captain said. It's just the... He didn't finish. The chief mate radioed from below. "Chief mate to bridge." "Go ahead, chief mate," the captain said. The chief mate is Schultz. Schultz told him they needed to transfer water from the port to the starboard ramp tank. The captain gave the okay and hung up. "I'm not liking this list," Davidson said to no one in particular. Moments later, the low vibration of the ship's engine suddenly went quiet. The rumbling of the engine was one of the constants of life at sea, and its cessation created an unsettling void that was immediately replaced by dread. "I think we lost the plant," Davidson said. The switch to a port list had ultimately moved the oil away from the pump, causing the engine to shut down. It was 6:13 a.m.
So something really, another thing that pointed out, as you said, so he was a captain that preferred being in his office instead of being up in the, you know, with the rest of his mates or just walking around the ship, knowing his crew, and his reliance on technology. There was a device on this ship that they were using in part with also the Weather Service to track where Hurricane Joaquin was going. But what I found, well, I mean, almost a head shaker, is the fact that the device was giving them information that was hours old.
Right. Right. He was provided with a weather forecasting service called the Bon Voyage system on board El Faro. But he was not informed that the Bon Voyage takes the latest NHC report, which during a hurricane comes out like every 3 hours. They take it and they augment it with other information, tidal charts and conditions, and various other meteorological bells and whistles. And that takes hours. And then to run it through the program, and then it's sent out as an email package. So by the time he was receiving these, they were 6 to 13 hours old. And there are places in the book where, you know, the real tragedy when you, I mean, reading this transcript was heartbreaking, because you hear these people talking, you know what's coming, and in many instances, crew members saw this coming as well and tried to do something about it.
And they did. They kept trying to tell the captain, right, you know, we're moving towards the eye of the storm. He's convinced, no, we're not.
Because he's looking at this Bon Voyage system, and they're getting the printout from the NHC.
The other excerpt that I picked out for you is giving us more of a taste of the other captain, Captain Heller, on the Minouche,
right,
and his approach to things. And I thought this was extremely telling. And again, as you said, he, you know what, both of these captains, well experienced.
Yeah.
But go ahead and read that excerpt. Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Okay, so I was just going to say, absolutely right. The the contrast between these captains and their approach is encapsulated in this section here. And it was life-saving and a much less sophisticated ship, but a captain who had also gone to sea professionally as a teenager from the Philippines. He joined a maritime academy and graduated and became a captain. He had sailed all over the world. So really, these two captains had very similar experience levels. They're just a different connection to the ocean and their job. So the Manouche, just so you know, because it's not widely known about this ship, is about 230 feet long, and it's sailing from the Miami River over to Port-de-Paix, Haiti. As his ship closed in on the open waters of the Windward Passage, Helera handed over the bridge to his chief mate, Henry Latigo, a broad-shouldered Filipino with a shaved head who, like Helera, had been sailing professionally since he was a teenager. Normally, after the day shift, Helera would walk the ship, chat with the crew, see if there were any problems, check if anyone needed anything. He liked to joke with his men. "Now we're going too fast for you to catch fish," he might say to the deck crew. He'd also check on the engine room to see how things were running. But today, Helera was tired, so he went down to the officer's mess to get something to eat. Lunch that day was turkey and plantains. Afterward, with a full belly, he headed to his cabin to catch some sleep. He said a little prayer as he lay down on his cot. At the foot of his bed was the black and silver cross he had fixed at the wall of every ship he sailed on. Then he closed his eyes. They weren't closed for long. The rolling and pitching were getting worse. But he was used to that. What disturbed his rest was a noise. Bang! It seemed to come from either under the ship or somewhere on the side. It was loud enough that he was concerned. He got up and went down to the engine room to ask the engineer if he had heard the sound. "No, Captain, didn't hear anything," the engineer said. Then added, "But it's loud down here." Helera climbed up to the bridge and asked Latigo if he'd heard anything. "Nope." Helera went back to his cabin, and as he lay down, he heard it again. Bang! He sat up. Reflexively, he knelt down to pray again. "Lord, is this a sign?" Then he got dressed and went onto the bridge. Now, you have me stop there, but I'm just going to add a couple of things. What he does after that, with no sign of distress to the ship at all, he musters his crew to the life-saving station. He brings everybody up on deck, tells them to put on their life vests, and prohibits them from going below.
And you talked to him later. You found him.
Yeah.
What did he tell you about that moment, and what was he thinking?
So, first of all, he's very religious. He grew up in the Philippines, and they were a devout family. And as a teenager, he wanted to become a priest. In fact, he had two other brothers, and they also wanted to become priests. And his mother said, "Listen, we're a poor family. Somebody has to go get a real job." So he marched off to Merchant Marine Academy. But when I was talking to him, he said, "This is the first time I haven't told anybody this." And then he started to cry. And he said that he had this, you know, epiphany. He believes that it was a religious experience that warned him to save his ship. You know, take that as you may. What's apparent to me from this is that he was so intuitive and so in touch with what was going on that he actually was able to, you know, sense something wrong early on. Sailors are known for their superstitions, right? No bananas on deck, no whistling on board brings bad wind, etc. So there's a long tradition of them looking to the extrasensory.
Real briefly, only because of time, real briefly, who was eventually blamed for the El Faro?
Well, the captain took most of the blame. I mean, both the Coast Guard and the NTSB say the primary driver of events was sailing into the storm. The company that owned the El Faro, Tote Marine, was also held culpable for, it was pointed out they were culpable for, lack of support. They didn't have anybody monitoring the ship or anybody in touch with the captain, etc.
You spell out so much very beautifully in this book about really everything that the day before, as they're heading out, such fascinating stories about these crews, the captains, the ships themselves, very old ships, and, you know, what happens after the tragedy. Again, one crew survives, obviously the crew of the El Faro. tragically all lost at sea. Again, talking with Tristram Cordham about his new book, The Storm, Two Ships, A Deadly... Oh, excuse me, Into the Storm, Two Ships, A Deadly Hurricane, and An Epic Battle for Survival. He's going to be at the Books and Books in Coral Gables Friday at 8 o'clock. Admission is free. Continue the story there. Tristram, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, do you think you could be a successful brewer? We talked with a Miami brewer who started with a do-it-yourself home kit. Now he's got one of the most popular flavors in the world. It's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, craft breweries have exploded in popularity across the country. The Brewers Association of America found 6,200 in 2016. That's up from 2,400 back in 2012. Miami has caught up in the trend with a number of breweries sprouting up across the city, especially in Wynwood. Jay Wakefield Brewing joined the neighborhood in 2015, has taken on unique challenges from the growing cost of rent to seeing their $20 specialty beers go for thousands of dollars or more online. I spoke with owner Jonathan Wakefield and head brewmaster Maria Cabre about where Miami is relative to New York or L.A. in the craft brew scene.
I think it's growing. I mean, I've lived here pretty much my whole life and started homebrewing here a long time ago, back before Total Wine hit, and there wasn't a lot of options to find craft beer, you know, and slowly but surely you started plugging in breweries, you know, one after another, and you see the scene really starting to take off and grow. It's nowhere near on the level of New York or San Diego. I mean, San Diego and Denver more than probably most. I mean, just meccas. I mean, I think San Diego alone has 150 breweries in the county. So it's definitely, we're still in the fledgling stage, I would say. But I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of fervent craft beer geeks or people enjoying craft beer on a much larger scale now than what there used to be.
Let's define craft beer. Explain what the term really means, because it could be misleading. I mean, you have, you know, these big companies that sometimes, you know, they buy out these beers, or they like to use that word. But how do we define it?
I would say it's a small business owned. It could be a few investors, not too many. You don't want to make it this, obviously macro is what you're referring to, but something craft, which is changing now. It's evolved now with food as well. People want craft food, things that are made from locally grown, either vegetables, fruit, anything. Well, it's the same with beer.
My understanding is, Jonathan, that your passion began with a $50 craft brew kit that your wife got you for Christmas. Is that true?
That was like the very, very beginning. Yeah, I mean, it was like a one test batch. It actually, me and my buddy used to go to this place up in Lauderdale. That was a brew on premise place. And we used to go there every weekend, and you would brew a beer there. It would get ferment there, stored there. You'd bottle it there. And it really kind of started there, and then the homebrew started with that kit. But I mean, I think it lasted one brew, and I had already gone out and bought like a whole setup, you know, for really getting into homebrewing.
So that first one, though, what was going on at that moment? What happened?
I went for a mango IPA to make it kind of like so that men and women would both like drinking it, kind of give it a fruity aspect, but still have a good hop bitterness to it. And it was a total mess, to say the least. Yeah. You know, you live and learn.
Well, I mean, after that was over, though, I mean, after that experience, you know, what made you think, yeah, I want to dive into this?
Well, I mean, at the time, I was a CPA. And it was, you know, I had always liked to cook and make something for other people, you know, get dirty with my hands, you know, create something that other people enjoy. So this was like another avenue for me beyond just cooking, and it really, really took off for me. It's something I really dove into, reading books, doing research, just really, you know, dove head into it, and I really enjoyed what I was doing.
Maria, a Gallup poll from 2016 found between beer, wine, or liquor, 23% of women said they most often would drink beer. Talk about the gender disparities when you see in beer drinkers.
Just in drinkers, not in the actual field.
Yeah.
Because I get the actual field question more than the drinker question.
Oh, okay.
We see, I mean, every shape, color, size, male, female, we see everything in coming to the tap room. I see females drinking very hoppy beers, very dark beers, not fruity beers, you know, so everyone's palate changes and evolves. And, you know, women also have palates, so they change and evolve. And you're seeing that now we see a huge increase in IPAs with women.
I would say it's just blown up. I mean, from me being a craft beer nerd geek since 2003, just seeing the amount of women drinkers that there are now, I mean, and what they like, I mean... When we opened, it was trying to make beers that were approachable by both male and female, and now it's really, it doesn't matter what it is because both genders drink it. It doesn't have to be profiled right. Either way.
As you told me, with that first time you were trying this out for yourself, you were thinking, I'm going to make something that right. both genders, right. Now it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. No, and because women before, you know, it used to be, they didn't like IPAs because it's too bitter. You know, that was the thing that you used to hear back in the day was like, women don't like IPAs because... It's just too bitter for them. Well, that doesn't exist anymore because I know plenty of women that drink hoppy, bitter IPAs just like guys do. So that doesn't exist anymore at all.
You know what, Maria, I was going to ask you too. I'm wondering, you know, have you faced any hurdles as a woman that's not only working in this male-dominated industry, but, you know, also, again, head brewmaster? I mean, what have you seen in your experience, your life?
I don't see it that way. And honestly, everyone that I've encountered as far as the industry is concerned has just welcomed me with open arms and told me how much, you know, how well I'm doing and keep going and everything. I've never felt any sort of sexism from anyone.
Are there enough women doing it though?
It's growing. I'll tell you that. It is definitely growing.
It's a ton. It's still behind.
Yeah.
It's still behind, but I think it's catching up very fast. I mean, we definitely led that way by hiring her. I mean, she started in the bottom as washing kegs, and then 6-8 months in, showed interest in learning how to brew. So, you know, I taught her how to brew beer on a commercial level, and that's where we are now. And now she, you know, she is the head brewer.
We've seen the Wynnewood community, it's this transformation and become this artistic center over the past decade, and of course a more fluent demographic, but also higher rent. Jonathan, was it important for you to have a physical storefront where people could drink as well as have the brewery?
We, as a whole, look for about a year and a half before we settled on Wynnewood. I mean, back then, I mean, we're talking... 5-6 years ago. I mean, Wynnewood was nothing what it is now. It definitely was completely different. I mean, the rent was much more affordable back then as well.
You're not the first person to say
it's, that. It's come a long way, but it at that time it was something that was open and the rent was a good price for us, you know, especially as a new business and trying to break in and a good location. We knew there was foot traffic, and that's only expounded as the years have gone on, but also... The neighborhood as a whole has completely changed as well. I mean, when we first opened, there were 10 art galleries on our street. Now there's none. You know, but I think, you know, you have a lot more high-end restaurants and more commercial spaces being pushed in, and that's jacked up the rent. So I think a lot of those places have been pushed out, but it's still popular. I don't think it has the same grit and feel as it did 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, and how has that changed, like, the customer? Who's coming in?
Well, definitely a lot of tourists. I mean, if I remember correctly, I think we're still, Wynnewood as a whole is still one of the top spots in Miami for tourism.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it is, the amount of traffic per year that we get is still one of the top in the county itself. It's still a lot of young people. I think our demographic is anywhere from 22 to 45. I mean, that's the main range, but a lot of tourists. We get a lot of locals. I mean, yeah. We get a lot of out-of-towners that know about the place and come to town just for the beer itself, but, you know, I mean, it just ranges so greatly.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Wakefield, owner of J. Wakefield Brewing, and his head brewmaster, Maria Cabre. We are talking about Miami's craft brew scene, the challenges they face with growth, and, of course, their unique events that are all coming up. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. I want to ask about process, Maria, but let me start with this. Can you pretty much take any flavor and make it work in a beer? Or are there just flavors you just, no, it's just, no, you can't do it.
We've tried a lot of different flavors, and it's hard to attain some flavors. I mean, it's just, you know, you have malts that can give you certain flavors in your beer, and you can add certain things to your beer, but then there's some things that just don't work.
Is there one that you wish it worked but didn't?
Toffee.
Wow, okay. Yeah. That's an interesting one, all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
what
hard.
What's one that that did work out? Probably better than you thought.
John actually brought rose water one day from his house, and he wanted me to use it on a beer, and I said, "I absolutely not. I hate rose water. It's a very strong taste. It can be
yes.
used and applied in a wrong way." And he said, well, you know, what if you use a certain fruit? And I was like, well, you know, what if we do lychee? So we came up with this lychee rosewater Berliner, and it's probably still one of the most popular Berliner Weisses. Anytime I make a keg of it, people go crazy. So I didn't expect it to be good, but it was.
From both of you, I'm just wondering, how do you react when, you know, you see a beer you've created sell for $20 and then you'll catch it later online for $120 or more, sometimes even in the hundreds, thousands of dollars?
It's mind-blowing.
Is that bad for business?
No, I don't think so. I think there's always been mixed feelings across the brewing community and industry on that. Some people think it's sacrilegious that someone else can take your beer that you produce and turn around and sell it for more money. But at the same time, those people that are doing that are driving demand. So how bad can you really speak on that? You know what I mean?
Does that mean at any point, though, you could raise your prices?
It does, but I don't think it, you know, I don't think that's doing it justice. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to price gouge anybody. We did in fact give that a test run where we did do a seller sale for beers that had been kept by us, kind of like if a restaurant had a wine cellar and had a bottle from 1964. I mean, you're not selling that at today's prices. You're selling that at a marked up retail price because that bottle doesn't exist anymore, so you can charge more money for that. That is the same thing that we did for the cellar sale, where we personally held on to these beers for a year and then let them go and charge an upsell, not what the secondary market would be, but what we thought it would cost if you were to buy it at a restaurant or something like that, per se, like a good wine would be.
I wanted to ask you about this. Your store advertised, what was it, back on April 20th, related event several weeks ago, which was supposed to feature terpenes injected into the beer. And of course, that's the 420 for people who
right.
don't know, the unofficial holiday for marijuana.
Right.
They use the terpenes. It's what gives marijuana strains their flavor. You had a battle with regulators on that.
When the guy came in and sold this to us, it was sold as it being approved and an okay thing to use by the federal government. And you know, you're kind of like, I guess misled a little bit on what was the real deal. So then I made Maria call, and then she can speak more upon, you know, what she heard from the feds themselves.
I mean, it is the TTB, which would be the federal government that regulates beer. I called and they said, yeah, you have to submit a formula along with lab work, which you have to send the beer off when you've injected it with the terpenes to a lab. 24 hours later, you get results, and then you submit those results, the paperwork with the formula, and then you'll get an approval.
And you know, for clarification, the terpenes themselves actually contain no THC or CBD.
Right.
It's just basically aromatic oil, like if you were to burn it in a candle. You know what
right.
I mean? It's
right.
just aromatic oil that contains flavor, but no other properties.
But what we had found when we were doing the staff testing was that some of them were dank, but it enhanced certain flavors. So we were using it more as a flavor enhancer versus, oh, you know, this beer smells like weed. Because that's not what we wanted to do with it. It was to get the certain aspects of that strain that would work well with the certain beers that we were pairing them with.
You have a big event coming up tomorrow. May the 4th be with you, also known as Star Wars Day. Jonathan, you are a big Star Wars fan. You're a Gen Xer like me. I take you as an Obi-Wan Kenobi, but am I wrong?
Definitely wrong.
I'm a Han Solo.
Oh, you're...
He's definitely Han Solo.
Okay, that's all right. It's Han Solo. I mean, so this, I mean, for you, you have people who come dressed up. This is like a comic book festival in a way. People
we started this 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be our fourth year
mm-hmm.
of doing this. It started very small, and it's grown every year. I think last year was crazy.
Massive.
It was awesome.
Again, Jonathan Wakefield, owner of J. Wakefield Brewing, and his head brewmaster, Maria Gabri, joining me in studio, again, talking about Miami's craft brew scene. May the 4th be with you. May the 4th, the big celebration, Star Wars Day. He's got a big party, and he may dress up as Han Solo. Jonathan, Maria, it's been a pleasure, man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jonathan, let me give you a few ideas just so you can write it down. Lightsaber Lager, Boba Fett Brown Ale, Obi-Wan Kenobi Kolsch, make it happen. All right, so we move from beer to food. Think about the foods that you like to mix. Better yet, think about sauces that you like to mix for a little extra flavor. Then imagine when a large company comes along and does the same thing and stuffs it in a bottle and slaps a sticker on it. Our intern Andrea Perdomo has this story.
Recently, Heinz released a short video about a new product that's not out yet. It's called Mayo Chup. The social media response was mixed. Some people were happy that finally their two favorite condiments could be found in one bottle. But some expressed discontent with Heinz trying to cash in on an idea they felt was not so original.
So many Latin American countries lay claim to this, right? Argentina has its version, Puerto Rico has its version.
Carlos Frias is the Miami Herald's food and dining editor. He weighed in on the reaction to the announcement from Heinz.
They are, yes, equally proud of it, but they are more upset when some, you know, big multinational corporation says, hey, we're going to prepackage that for you and we're going to charge you for that privilege.
And as for the name,
I think we can safely say it's been around long enough where we don't have to come up with a new name for it. Mayo Chup. I don't know about you, but Mayo Chup sounds like a noise that you make by accident. An embarrassing bodily noise. Oh, Mayo Chup.
Oh, I mayo chupped, right?
Exactly.
As a Venezuelan American, from my earliest memories, I've been eating mayo ketchup sauce that we call salsa rosada on everything from fried cheese sticks wrapped in dough, called tequeños, to hot dogs and burgers. I was curious to see how other cultures use the sauce. Chef Gabriel Chavez makes a version for the Venezuelan Peruvian fusion restaurant, Boca's House, in Coral Gables. He gave me a rundown on how the restaurant prepares the sauce.
La salsa rosada creo que es una fusión. Bueno.
He tells me the restaurant sauce is based on how it's made in Venezuela. A mixture of ketchup and mayonnaise with a Peruvian touch. Sriracha for spiciness.
Y le incluimos sriracha.
People from different countries have been using mayonnaise and ketchup mix for generations. And although it uses two very simple ingredients, it's made all different ways. I asked a number of my colleagues how they like to enjoy it.
It's a mayo base, and then you add the ketchup to it. And then you can a little bit of like lime or vinegar.
Oh, I like to put a little bit more ketchup, actually. The taste of the ketchup a little bit more.
We just like mix the mayo and the ketchup, and we add hot sauce to it. And it's really good.
I mean, more mayo than ketchup, but that's it.
Mix one part ketchup and two parts mayonnaise.
That last voice was my fellow intern, Danny Wong. He told me he first tried the sauce as a child in South Korea.
Back in Korea, when I was growing up, that was totally a thing that just some chip company had written on the back of their chip wrapper that as a way to best enjoy their chips. It would say, you know, eat it with mayonnaise.
No matter what you call your ketchup mayo mix or how you like to prepare it, Heinz is planning to release their version later this year. And we'd like to know how you like to prepare your mayo ketchup sauce. Tweet at us at WLRN Sundial or comment on our Facebook page. For Sundial on WLRN, I'm Andrea Perdomo.
I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. Talk to you again on Monday.